The Guardian.
Welcome to this week's atmospheric edition of Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and you join me here at the Odeon West End, in the foyer of the cinema that's the very hub of the London Film Festival every year. This year it kicks off on the 15th of October for the 52nd edition of the LFF, and we've just seen what the lineup will be. I'm joined by Guardian film critic Sam Brooks to digest the plethora of films that have just unfurled before us. But first, the actor David Hewlett's performance as the manic, troubled Johnny in Mike Leigh's 1993 film Naked created one of the great iconoclastic fictional characters of British cinema. Hewlett's acting career from then on has been a kind of escape from the creation of Johnny. This week sees David Hewlett playing a concentration camp commandant in The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, a Disney adaptation of the hugely successful children's book by John Boyne. I caught up with David Hewlett earlier this morning to discuss his career, Johnny in Naked, and of course, playing opposite Marlon Brando in The Island of Dr. Moreau. But first, let's have a listen to Hewlett in action in The Boy in Striped Pyjamas.
Bruno, you have to at least give the place a chance. I promise you, it won't be long before you're...
Why do the farmers wear pyjamas? I can see them from my window.
The thing is, Bruno, those people... Well, you see, they're not really people at all.
Bruno, who told you it was a farm? Was it Maria?
No. It is a farm, isn't it?
Yes.
Is it still of your new job?
All you need to know about my work here, Bruno, is that it's very important to our country and to you. We're working very hard to make this world a better place for you to grow up in.
But you're not a farmer. You're a soldier.
Bruno, can you come and help me finish sorting out in the kitchen?
David Hewlett, welcome to Film Weekly. Thanks so much for joining us here for your film and your role in The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, which is quite a scary role, I've got to say. You look quite calm and welcoming here, but as a concentration camp commandant, you've struck the fear of God into me.
Really? Really? Yeah. Well, it's a difficult part, but it's... Mainly not to portray him as a stereotype or as a cliche, because one of the whole points of the film is you see it through the eyes of my son. So initially you see it, that I appear to be a loving father, a very caring family man, and the film is really about my son discovering the true identity, the true meaning of what I do.
I mean, the film sort of works as a sort of a fable in a way that your wife Vera Farmiga, who I think is excellent in the film.
Yes, she's really, really, really great, I think.
I mean, she provides a sort of moral compass for the audience. She's more shocked, whereas you provide a sort of almost fable kind of symbol for, I suppose, Germany at the time, which started off kind of thinking it was doing the right thing and then kind of realised that, you know, it was growing more and more horrific.
Yeah, and... I mean, as much as we see it through Bruno's eyes, my son, we also see it through her eyes, my wife's eyes, played by Vera, because she also has her own slow discovery of the truth during the film, which is based on fact, is that the wife of Rudolf Hoss, who was the commandant of Auschwitz, I don't play Rudolf Hoss, but it's obviously based on this kind of character, did not know the truth of the death camp, so they were sworn to secrecy. And indeed, I believe it from everything I've read, which is quite detailed research, that she did not even know the true nature of the camps. She obviously knew they were prison camps, but, you know, everyone had prison camps during the war. The British put people in camps during the war. It's an accepted fact of war, but she did not know anything about the final solution, the genocide that was going on, until a chance remark dropped by a subordinate of Hoss's. So that's very much based on truth, and it shows the slow breakdown of the family in many ways.
Did Hoss know about the final solution? Obviously, he was instrumental in implementing it, but did he know when he took the post? I mean, and you've obviously read quite a lot about him and the events.
Yes, indeed, he knew what he was there to do, but it was a slow build, because I think he took, I can't quite remember now, but I think he took over Auschwitz when it wasn't, and Birkenau when it wasn't first working at the level it came to work on, but he was instrumental in the building up of that camp, and the instructions coming through from the top became increasingly pernicious. So maybe he didn't expect to commit these murders on such a mass level, but he was certainly, 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 without doubt, complicit, absolutely.
We said earlier that you sort of approach each part much the same, whichever film it is, but a film like this that is dealing with such a delicate subject in such a delicate way, because what you're doing is you're trying to kind of humanise someone who's obviously normally a villain or a cardboard cutout character. Mm. Do you approach something like this with, I mean, you said you'd done research, there must be some sort of difference that you do. You must be aware of how delicate you have to handle such material.
I think the main thing is that it was very hard to find a parallel in my own life. Most things I do, even if they're period pieces, you'll find someone in your own life or from your past who you can relate it to, who you can and somehow base it on, which is the way I work, which is something I took from working with Mike Lee and many years ago, where it's based on a real person. And of course, this is very difficult to base on a real person because I don't know, not many people do know anyone as evil as this. I do know one or two people who've killed people, but even they weren't good models really to look at for this. So that was a little different, and the way I did it indeed was just to do an enormous amount of research and immerse myself in the literature of that period, watch some wonderful documentaries, and do only that, and didn't read anything else and didn't watch any TV, and just tried to, you know, and kept myself fit and tried to sort of do a military workout every day.
I suppose with, you mentioned Mike Lee and the breakthrough role of Johnny, that was so extraordinary. It's still, I can't believe it's 1993 as well, because I mean, I can see you like it was yesterday. Okay, yeah. I mean, is that good, or in a way, sort of, I think most people can still see you as Johnny and they have sometimes a hard time not sort of forgetting you. It's an unforgettable role and kind of means that people will always remember it.
Well, that's a good thing, I've always thought. I've never felt like it was an albatross around my neck. I always think I'm very proud to have done something that's so memorable and will go down in sort of film history. I hope that people can get over seeing me as that character while they're watching me as another character. And I've done so much between 1993 and now, several films a year. So, maybe it's just because the way I look right now is not so dissimilar to how I looked in the film. I don't know, I'm quite flattered you say that, since it's 15 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, but
I mean, you won Best Actor at Cannes for that. Yeah. And in a way, it was the first time that I think I'd seen you. I think you'd been in a couple of things. Mm. And it's such a way to sort of kind of make your mark with Best Actor at Cannes. It sort of doesn't get much better than that, obviously, Oscars and all that. Yeah. But it's kind of the only way is, I know it's very difficult to manage a career, I'd say. After that, getting those highs, normally you build up to them, but to start on a high must have been quite difficult.
Well, it wasn't difficult. It was just strange, you know, because what happened after that, coming from working totally in Britain and then being thrust into an international film world, and, you know, mainly Hollywood, and indeed making a few Hollywood films, well, quite a number of Hollywood films, but initially some rather, you know, big and stupid Hollywood films with big special effects and talking beasts. And, well, I've done a lot of film with talking beasts, far too many.
They always say don't work with animals, but you work with kind of CGI animals a lot.
Yeah, I think I hold the record for working on more films where animals talk. I've never looked at, if anyone wants to check that out there, and against any other actor, but if you count the number of films I'm in where at some point some creature opens its mouth and has something to say, I think I've done quite a lot of them. I think I've done too many now, so I think I'm knocking that on the head.
You look like you're having fun to me, but on the screen.
Sometimes, not all the time. Yeah,
but there were some funny films in there. I mean, Island of Dr. Moreau, that was a strange one.
Yeah, well, talking animals again. Yeah. I'm the only one in the film who's not an animal talking. Me and Marlon Brando, everyone else, and Val Kilmer, everyone else is a talking animal. That was one of the high points of my talking animal career.
But that was that became sort of a famous film, not because of you, but because of Val Kilmer and Marlon Brando.
Yeah, well, there are many, 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 many stories about that, many myths about the making of that film, except that they're not myths. Anything you've heard about the making of that film, no matter how bizarre out there, is true, and it is probably stranger. No matter what you've heard and go like, yeah, well, that sounds a little apocryphal, I'm sure it wasn't, but it was absolutely true.
And how did you cope through all that?
Oh, nearly had a nervous breakdown. I was administered Valium at one point, and I'm a really calm kind of fellow. I'm not really the sort of guy who needs Valium, but I was administered Valium at one point.
So were you caught in the middle between Val and Marlon?
And John Frankenheimer, it should be said. It wasn't so much Val and Marlon. I mean, it certainly was a bit Val and Marlon. And me, and Firouz Balk, but it was actually mainly John Frankenheimer, who was I think a little out of control and rather flailing around, not knowing what he was doing. And at the same time, you've got the craziness of Brando and the kind of quite wonderful nuttiness of Val Kilmer. I think he's been much maligned and vilified for not just that film, but several other things. But Val is actually, I think, a rather wonderful person. I think he gets some bad press, but and certainly on that he did.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
But, you know, and he deserves some of it, but we all deserve some of it. I cancelled filming one night because they were asking us to do something that was just, you know, beyond the pale. It was like, this would never happen. And so I became one of those actors who was like, I'll be in my trailer. I can't believe I was doing it.
Is it infectious? Because you don't seem like a massive lovey to me, everyone's doing it, you think,
well, I saw it could be done, you know. And because I think we lost 14 days shooting on that film just from people not coming out of their trailers. In fact, not coming out of their trailers, most of the time they didn't even leave the hotel to get to their trailers. It's not, I'm not leaving my hotel to come to the set even if we're going to shoot whatever we're going to shoot this day. Because it was not Richard Stanley's original script. It was a whole new script that was being written by the day. And then we were changing everything. Someone would disagree with something on that day, but we had to shoot it, and it was just like putting a blowtorch to a jigsaw puzzle. It was absolutely astonishing.
It must have been a bit odd, because clearly you're someone as you, and you, as you said, you like to immerse yourself in roles, and you're sort of as method as kind of British actors get. To kind of come to meet Brando must have been a tantalising kind of hero kind of moment, and then to find out that he's a big fat bloke who won't come out of his trailer must be a bit disappointing.
No, he wasn't disappointing. I mean, I wasn't actually one of those actors who idolise other actors. And so, I mean, obviously I knew who Brando was, and I knew his importance and his reputation. And But it was a real thrill, and it was actually really wonderful because I actually got to know him in a very peculiar way, in that we were making this peculiar film, but also that he very much took me under his wing and would have me around a lot. He'd have me in his trailer playing chess and chatting away, and you know, he used to get changed in front of me, and it was just quite extraordinary that I found myself in this situation as Marlon's confidant, when about 2 weeks before I never even dreamed that I would be in the presence of such a kind of a legendary actor. But I became very, very close to him during that period, and you know, used to sit there thinking how many millions of people would kill to be in this situation, and yet I was with him so much that sometimes I was quite bored and thinking I'd like to go now. And I said, I've got to go to the bathroom, Marlon. And he's like, no, use mine. And I'm like, well, you've got to get changed, I better go now. And he's like, no, stay, I can change in front of you. You've seen a man before. So it was quite disturbing. God bless him.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope he's listening. David Thewlis, thanks for coming on Film Weekly.
Thank you very much.
The great, the affable David Thewlis there, and the boy in the striped pyjamas, is on release around the UK from Friday the 12th of September. As I said, we're recording this week's podcast here at the launch of the 52nd London Film Festival at the Odeon West End Cinema, where there's a big hubbub as the programme has just been announced. Before she was gobbled up by the rest of the voracious media down here, I spoke to festival director Sandra Hebron. Here we are in the foyer of the Odeon West End for the launch of the 52nd London Film Festival, and I'm joined by artistic director of that festival, Sandra Hebron, who's just unfurled her programme in front of the nation's press. This is such a well-attended event, Sandra. I'm amazed by these things.
It's fantastic, isn't it? I mean, you know, we're at 800-plus attendance, which is wild. I mean, especially on a day like today, isn't everyone worried about big bangs and black holes?
Yes. Should people be working?
Well, and also apparently we're clashing with the Rear of the Year Awards, so...
Because I thought, Sandra, that this was a particularly strong programme that you've just done, revealed. You mentioned that it was, Venice was a bit weak this year, and all the reports saying that it was. You seem to have managed to kind of position yourself very interestingly this year.
Well, I do think that we're in that very fortunate position where, because we can select from, you know, we start programming in January. So although, obviously, you know, we like to have a lot of premieres in the festival, we can select from throughout the year. So as well as the great films that we've found that are finished very recently, it does mean that, you know, the best films that we saw in Sundance, in Berlin, in Cannes, we can bring them into the festival. And I think that makes our job massively easier. I mean, of course, you know, we could still choose some bad ones. But I think that between us, you know, we have got a really strong lineup.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of said, well, it's not a vintage year for cinema, but I mean, there's 20 films here that I'm desperate to
see
again.
I mean, it certainly wasn't me saying it's not a vintage year for cinema. It's interesting that's what some of your fellow journalists are saying. That's not my experience. And I think one of the interesting things about programming the festival each year is people have this thing about there are good years for cinema, there are bad years for cinema. And actually, when we get to looking at what's coming in October, I don't often find that there is a bad year. I think that sometimes, you know, you remember the things that you've seen most recently. So if you have a kind of less than thrilling festival experience, you think that the world is full of bad films. But actually, if you look back over the year in a more, sort of reflective way, then you see that actually there are great films coming
Well, and
through.
You managed to get, I mean, the class, the Laurent Canté film, Entre les Murs, which won at Cannes, surprised everyone by coming up. I mean, I haven't seen it since that great day at Cannes when I thought, God, I'm so glad I saw this film. I love that film.
Absolutely,
and it's
yes.
forming your one of your centrepiece
gardens. It's the Sight and Sound Gala, yes, yeah. No, I mean, that's great, and there are other great films from Cannes, like Waltz with Bashir and Che and Hunger
Can you set us straight with Che? I was talking earlier with, I noticed that Che's here, the St. Steven Soderbergh epic biopic of Che Guevara starring Benicio del Toro, who I gather will be coming
yes,
here.
Yes, he will.
Is this the same monumental kind of lump of two films we saw in Cannes at 4 hours?
It's two separate films. Each film is slightly shorter than in Cannes, but trimmed by a matter of minutes, 6 minutes each, I think. Could be wrong, but it's had a kind of minor trim. But it's very much two different films. However, Stephen has a request that whenever the film screens in festivals, that they are presented one after the other with a short interval between the two. So actually what we will be doing is we will be presenting it in that way, but we'll then also be presenting the two films separately. And when the film goes on theatrical release here, it will be released as Che Part 1 and Che Part 2.
That's excellent information. A lot of people were concerned about that. I love the look of Dubya, the Oliver Stone film.
Absolutely.
Have you seen all of these films before you programmed this?
I haven't seen every film in the festival, because obviously the festival has its own programmer, Michael Hayden, and we have about 12 program advisors. So they have pulled together, you know, sort of various parts of the program too. So I haven't seen all of the films that they've recommended. I have seen the majority of the films on the square. I've seen the gala titles. Yeah.
And it is very exciting. And certainly the opening and closing nights look terrific as well. Danny Boyle's Slumdog Millionaire closing it, Frost Nixon opening it. I'm delighted to see Hunger again, which is one of the great British films of the year. Very strong British lineup.
It is. I mean, and what's quite interesting is obviously, Hunger, Terence Davies's Of Time and the City, just stunning. Jennifer from Michael Winterbottom, The Other Man from Richard Eyre. Films by filmmakers who are, I mean, with the exception of Steve McQueen, who have a kind of reputation. But then, you know, Steve McQueen and, you know, a host of new British filmmakers making their sort of first or second film, so people like Pat Holden and Justin Carrigan coming, Richard Jobson obviously with the film in the festival again, it's great to
and
see
Nick
that
Moran.
There's and Nick Moran, but the films have got real kind of energy and they're incredibly diverse. I mean, you know, Nick Moran's film Telstar is some distance from Richard Jobson's New Town Killers, so you know, that's one of the great things, is that there is this incredible spread.
It looks very encouraging to me, Sandra, and congratulations on assembling what's such a good lineup. If you have this is the terrible question, but the BFI recently asked me to name my one film for their to share in 75 years. I noticed they asked you as well. What did you choose?
I haven't done mine
you
yet.
You haven't done yours yet?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to choose one film out of this festival.
No, I'm not going to choose one out of the festival.
Sandra.
I mean, it's like choosing between your children. How could I possibly do that?
Well, we will see you running between all of these screens, so you're going to see them all throughout the festival. Please join us at various points throughout the festival. Tell us how it's going on. Have you got your dresses sorted out for opening and closing night?
That comes next.
Sandra Hebron, thanks very much. Go get fitted.
Thank you. Thanks, Jason.
Well, you heard me talking to Sandra Hebron there, Artistic Director of the London Film Festival. We're talking about the very strong British lineup there, and one of the directors that Sandra's giving a debut and a big premiere to for his first film as a director is the actor Nick Moran, famous from Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, of course, now turned director on Telstar, which will be debuting here at the LFF. I caught up with Nick earlier to congratulate him on being picked. Congratulations, first of all, on being part of the London Film Festival, Nick.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure and an honour to be here.
Yeah, I mean, it must be a big honour to be part of the LFF.
With Telstar, because it's as people may or may not know, it's the Joe Meek story, and Joe Meek was the world's first independent record producer. He was this gay, speed addicted, devil worshipping, tone deaf Gloucester farmhand who built a recording studio over a handbag shop, and had three. three number ones, some of the biggest hits of the 60s, including the song Telstar, which is the biggest selling record of all time. The first British number one in America, first song to be number one both sides of the Atlantic. And Johnny Remember Me and Have I the Right and Just Like Eddie and all these. And some very, very oddball, strange Missed by a Mile tunes as well. But
I love Just Like Eddie.
Oh, it's a thing that everyone, you know who plays a guitar on that?
No, go on.
Richie Blackmore.
The great Richie Blackmore.
Who's in the film, right? You know, so, but I wrote the bio with my writing partner James Six. We wrote the play, which was got Olivier nominated and picked up a couple of gongs a couple of years ago. And then Simon Jordan phoned me up out of the blue.
I was mobile phone magnate, owner of Crystal Palace.
Owner of Crystal Palace, and also who was backed the play. He phoned me up out of the blue when I was in LA about to cover myself in latex and do Stargate, I think. And he's, you know,
this is for work.
Yes, this wasn't just socially. This was not a fancy dress party. You know. No, he phoned me up and said, "Come home, let's make the film." And he's the producer of the movie, and he backed it, bankrolled it completely. He's completely funded by.
So this is his, I know you brought him with you, shining like a big blonde beacon.
Yes,
he is. He's very loud character. This is his first foray in the film.
Yeah, yeah, and it's he also produced the Ray Winston Sweeney Todd. That was his first foray into it. But it's something he wanted to do. He's been a big fan of the show. And he didn't just bankroll it. He is the producer. He's here as the film's producer because he does, like it or not, you know, he gets really involved. So, he was in the edit. He was on set. He did throw his.
But Nick, this is your first film was a director. Yep. I mean, most people would know you as an actor. Yes. So your film was a director. His sort of first major film was as a producer.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
He's quite a colourful character to kind of deal with. The best yeah, it's, as anyone it's, who's really observed a football.
It's fun and games, but I mean, I think it's a very colourful film, and we had a fantastic team. The other producers were Dave Reed and Adam Boland produced Layer Cake. I had a lot of the best people that I'd worked with over the years in the crew. I got to ask them if they'd be in my film, please. And then also the reason that we've got such a stonking stellar cast is because people had seen the play, and you know you just had to ask them if they wanted to be in the film.
So who you got?
Well, Kevin Spacey obviously is that's the big coup. And you know Kevin's is an old friend of mine, and he's a sort of patron of the arts, and he was a fan of the show, and that was great getting Kevin. But also James Corden, that everybody knows, is a sort of man of the hour, but he'd seen the play, and Tom Burke is another sort of rising star, JJ Field, Pam Ferris, and then we get Ralph Little does the little term, but then we've got these fantastic cameos from a lot of the guys of the time. You know, I've got the real life Johnny Layton doing a cameo. I've got the real life. I've got the real life Chaz Hodges from Chaz and Dave, who was Joe's bass player. He does a cameo in it.
This is an era that obviously you love. Why take us back to that?
If everything had gone absolutely massively tits up, I could win Mastermind. That's the way. The consolation prize is that I spent so long trawling through discographies and finding out little bits of trivia, you know. And it's great being on set with actors where you can just tell them what colour socks the guy was wearing and where they're going to be next Wednesday and what time of day it is, and you're just full of answers. And I'm absolutely brilliant designer. The film's got a very high-end look, but that's because there's so many little specifics that you find out over the years.
So is this, are we going to see you acting still, or are you now Nick Moran director?
No, I think you've got to do, I think they can sort of feed each other, that's the plan. I'd like to be in films as good as the ones I make, and hopefully that's a really tough call. After this, it should be really challenging to be. I can't be in a crap film having made a really good one.
Listen, I've got to ask you this, Nick. Rock and Roller's out at the moment. Yeah. You've seen the Guy Ritchie back to form, that kind of, everyone knows you still from Lock, Stock and cherishes you that. What do you get when you see the Rock and Roller's back out?
I think what I like about Rock and Roller is that, for me, I think it's a sort of changing of the mantle, because so many fantastically talented actors that are 10 or 12 years younger than me, and you know, me and Statham and Fleming and the rest, we've all had our day, really. We've had our day in the sun, thanks very much, lovely. Moving on, you know, we're all knocking on 40, that's the end of that. But people like Toby Keeble, Tom Hardy, you know, they are great actors, and it's nice to see them given the same sort of platform that I was. And there's so much young talent in that, as well as a bit of experience, and I think that's what's really refreshing.
It's great
to see a young actor get who can cope with it, get a bit of exposure in a really good film, and that's what's good about it.
Well, it's lovely to see you as part of the London Film Festival. Wish you luck with the premiere there, Nick.
I'm sure you'll be there.
Of course I will, and we'll have you back on then.
Thanks,
cheers. Man. We're in the foyer of the Odeon West End. The 52nd London Film Festival programme has just been unfurled before myself and Guardian critic Zan Brooks. Zan, we've got the programme in front of us. It's a mass of names. We've seen a clip reel of about 30 films from about 40 different countries. It's always quite daunting when you get a big festival landed in front of you. But the LFF, I've got to say this year, looks very exciting.
It looks great. Yeah, we've just sat through 30 minutes of basically a crash course sneak peek at the films on offer, some of which are familiar from previous festivals of the year, such as Cannes. There's a lot of Cannes stuff there, as there always is, but some really good Cannes stuff. And then there's also films that really we have no idea what they're going to be like, apart from the little taster of clips that we've just seen.
It does look like a strong year for British cinema. There's stuff directors I haven't heard of for ages coming back. We've heard from Nick Moran, Justin Kerrigan, who made Human Traffic. He seems to have come up again.
Terence Davis, the old kind of hand, making his nostalgic salute to the Liverpool of his youth. Is there, and yeah, there's a lot of kind of quite what look like quite kind of gritty social realist sort of British comedies and dramas thrown in there for good measure too,
and quite low budget as well, kind of digital or at least shot on sort of video, and it looks
yeah, which is kind of fitting because how the LFF differs from other festivals is that it's a much more democratic festival. It's open to the public. You get a big democratic spread of films, and you also probably get films that are more low budget, that are more experimental, and, you know, just kind of opening up the medium to everybody who wants to have a go, really.
Right, well, tickets will be on sale shortly, and you can book them on through the box office, which is 020-7928-3232. Of course, go on to bfi.org.uk/LFF. Sam, what would you recommend people get their bums early on the seats for?
Oh, if you want the kind of the hot tickets, the obvious hot tickets, we've got Oliver Stone's George W. Bush biopic, W. So this is Stone's, from the looks of it, very sensitive portrait of the president as a spoilt drunk buffoon. And obviously Stone is releasing that in the run-up to the November election. And yet you can see it here, I guess, first.
Yeah, it looks like a great cast, which the clip we just saw, the sort of trailer for it, it doesn't build the cast as the actors, it builds them as the people.
As the people, playing, the real rogues gallery of the Bush administration. So you've got Tandy Newton as Condoleezza Rice. You've got a Dick Cheney lookalike in there. You've got Colin Powell. You've got all of the gang basically lined up, and Josh Brolin, of course,
and
as
Daddy,
W.
And Daddy as well.
And Daddy, who at one stage gets into a bit of a fight with his wayward son. The other obvious hot ticket, of course, is Bond. The Quantum of Solace will be playing at this year's festival, and we've just seen a little trailer for that. Obviously, not much to go on there, apart from the fact that Daniel Craig seems to walk around without a shirt on, and Gemma Arterton without a bra on. So, you know, Bond knows what it's doing.
Yeah, Bond's an interesting one, because I thought it might be the closing night film, but that's not. That's gone to Danny Boyle's Slumdog Millionaire. A little clip we saw of that had featured kind of ghetto children running across rubbish tips.
Yeah, it looked... it's set in India, but it definitely had the kind of City of God
vibe.
Yeah. With the sort of the handheld camera, the sun glare, the slums, and the kind of the urgency and the turbulence that you saw in City of God. I've heard very good things about this. I think it just played recently in Toronto and got very good reviews over there. And, you know, Danny Boyle is one of the great hopes of British cinema, or certainly was when he did Trainspotting like 12 years ago. He's had a kind of slightly patchy career since then, but he's always one to watch.
Yeah, I like him as well. I think he's very interesting, and his films sort of underrated. They slip by, some of them a big budget, like...
He does his own thing. Sometimes it works great, and sometimes it doesn't, but he's, you know, he's an iconoclast.
Another friend of Film Weekly that I noticed included on the programme was Alex Gibney, who won his Oscar for Taxi to the Dark Side. And last time he was on the show, he was telling us about the new film Gonzo that he'd made about Hunter S. Thompson, a documentary. That's the documentary gala here at the LFF. That looks fascinating.
Yeah, that looks great. I mean, you know, Thompson is such a sort of fascinating subject for a documentary because he lived so much of his life in front of the camera and had a career that had huge ups and downs and drug-fueled mishaps, culminating, of course, in his suicide a couple of years ago. So this is rich material for Gibney to kind of get his teeth into.
There's a couple of looks like sparkly Hollywood gems on there, probably a bit cool as well, but they probably could go on to Oscars. And I'm talking about films like The Brothers Bloom, which looked like a sort of comedy action thriller. With
that looked kind of stupid to me,
didn't it?
There were a couple of films here,
Mark Ruffalo and Rachel Weisz, and I was a bit concerned what the film The Other Man, Richard Ayer's new film, a fine British director, but it sort of had Laura Linney and Liam Neeson and Antonio Banderas. Couldn't really understand what he was saying there, Banderas.
Yeah, I couldn't quite get that. And another film that I kind of was slightly put off from the trailer was Easy Virtue, which is the Noel Coward comedy, which looked like a kind of very twittish British, you know, country house comedy.
Well, based on Noel Coward's script, but it was directed, I noticed, by Stephen Elliott there,
yes.
who made Priscilla Queen of the Desert, and has really not done very much
since. Did you do Serpent's Kiss? Was that him?
I don't think he did. He did something called Welcome to Whoop Whoop. But, I mean, no, yeah, there you see. I pulled that one out of the bag. He really has a sort of, a man hasn't really done much.
Yeah, and this didn't look too promising from the sign of things.
There seems to be a lot of Colin Firth around.
Of Colin Firth. There's also a kid's film called The Secret of Moonacre, which looked a bit cheesy from the looks of it. But it was very nice to see, or to hear, what I believe was Ray LaFontaine, the great trailer voiceover guy, in what may well have been his swan song performance, because of course he died last year. He completed The Secret of Moonacre voiceover, and then checked out for good.
What a way to go, Zan. No, not the Family Gala, never my favourite. I did notice that Steven Soderbergh's Che is in the line up there, and that Benicio del Toro was promised to us here. I'm wondering if this was the same that we saw in Cannes, the sort of 3-hour version.
4 hours, wasn't it? I think it was like 4.5 hours.
Maybe 6 days,
that played in Cannes. By the looks of it, it probably is, because the original intention was to release Che as two separate films, one focusing on his kind of earlier kind of guerrilla work and coming of age and things like that, and the rest on the Cuban Revolution. I imagine this is the full kind of butt-numbing 4.5-hour version.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a film festival without such a thing right in the middle of it. One thing that really excited me was the Treasures from the Archive. I always think are very good at the London Film Festival. The BFI can draw on all this stuff they've got in their drawers. And they seem to have restored an African film I've never seen before called Tuki Buki.
It looked absolutely stunning. I'm assuming it's slightly from the 1970s. It had that kind of 70s film stock, that very kind of luscious colour. We basically saw 30 seconds of it, and it looked beautiful, and it looked like a kind of side of Africa that we don't really see. It seemed to be the kind of African middle class sitting by a pool and smoking and drinking. It looked great, so I'm wanting to check that out.
So, Zan, I mean, Sandra Hebron made the point in her speech that Venice, the critics sort of said this year is not a vintage year for cinema. Venice was very weak as a festival, but the LFF certainly seems to have kind of almost benefited from that and kind of got the best of the rest and looks forward to what looks like a decent year. And in the end, you know, there's certainly 30 films here that I would say look very strong and worth seeing.
Well, Venice was kind of scrambling for the films on offer at that time, whereas obviously the LFF can cast its net a bit further, so you basically almost got a kind of greatest hits package of the festival year. As we said, some of the great films from Cannes, The Class, which won the Cannes Palme d'Or, Laurent Cantet's film.
Which I can't wait to see again.
Other film that I can't wait to see again is Waltz with Bashir, the animation from Cannes. So you've got the best of Cannes, you've got kind of the best of Venice, you've got the best of Toronto, and then you've got some of the big films that are maybe going to be Oscar contenders early next year. So this is a really kind of strong lineup this year, I think.
Is the LFF something that you like? Did you grow up kind of scuttling between screenings?
Absolutely.
And
you know, when I was sort of first in this business, London Film Festival was the only festival I could go to because I lived in London and was vaguely working in the media. And I used to go kind of religiously, and I would, you know, get my press pass and just, you know, tick off all the films that I wanted to see. And I'd always start out wanting to see like 30 and would end up seeing maybe 15. And it was still a great strike rate. And it's a festival that I've got an awful lot of fondness for.
Yeah, me too. And I look forward to hosting podcasts from there, interviewing all the people. And of course, Zan, you'll be joining me to run through what we've seen during the LFF.
So I'm looking forward to it.
You'll be doing more than 15 films this year, mate, I'll tell you.
I'm looking forward to that too.
Well, that's all we've got time for this episode of Film Weekly. A big thank you to all of my guests and to my hosts, in particular the London Film Festival, who've had us down here at their launch at the Odeon West End, the great David Thewlis, Sandra Hebron and Nick Moran. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer down here at the Odeon West End, Jason Phipps, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.